Good evening. I'm not Flossie, but don't worry. Be patient. She'll be along in a moment. One of the better-kept secrets of the galaxy, at least until now, is that the famous crime author Tabitha Crispy is actually a pseudonym of our very own Flossie. She has graciously consented to us serialising her new novel, and thus the Hutton Orbital Radio Book Club is proud to bring you part one of This Other Eden, being the casebook of Miss Marbles and the story of the purloined pottery read by the author herself. So, sit back, turn down the lights, top up the megagin, turn the lights back up again because you realise you've missed the glass in the dark and spilled your gin, and prepare to be amazed by this baffling tale.
My name is Miss Marbles, and I should say at the outset that I'm nothing special, just an ordinary pilot. And although I try to live a quiet life, trouble has a habit of finding me, much like Cecil can find the last gin bottle hidden behind the sofa. The beginnings of this particular piece of trouble came in the form of a hushed noise outside my home, here in the ex-convent of St. Mary's in mid-installation of Ngobadoo. With my pin-sharp hearing, I determined it to be the sound of a man with a mop and a strange, dance-like way of moving across the floor. This dance led into my door, at which point he pushed a nose underneath it and mop danced away again before I could open the door to see what he looked like. Intrigued, I opened the neatly folded piece of paper and read, "Dear Miss Marbles, we would be delighted if you could attend our Little Orbital's annual fete and be a judge in our competition, specifically the category for Best Watercolour Painting of a Thargoid Wearing a Kilt, Highland Tartan. Never want to pass up an opportunity to see new places. I packed my bags and set sail." Of course, I know that spaceships don't have sails, but Seth Thruster really doesn't sound have the same ring to it, does it? I packed a light lunch for the trip. After all, how long could it take? Anywhere with a name containing orbital can't be that far, surely. My goodness, by the time I arrived, I'd not only finished my lunch, but I'd eaten all of the emergency rations, emptied the ship's minibar, found only on ships from Lake on Spaceways, and knitted a scarf long enough to fit 14 doctors at the same time. If anyone else says the word Hutton to me again, they'll get a karate chop to the larynx. Where was I? Oh yes, on an orbital that looks well past its prime, circling a dull grey little world that some might call Eden, in the same way that they call tall blokes tiny, or loose knockers brains. Still, I thought, now that I'm here, I might as well make the most of it, and so I went to the assembly hall on deck 2 to view the exhibits for the fair. As I circulated around the various tables, I was struck by just how much spare time some people had, and how arbitrary some of the categories were. My suspicion was that when the show was first created, the organiser's wife had a very specific talent, and the competition was created to make sure that she always won. Why else would there be a category for a fruitcake, where all of the fruit had to be at the bottom and the top had to be the same colour as the lead in a 2B pencil? The event had obviously grown since that time, but eccentricity was obviously still the name of the game. How else could you explain giving prizes for biggest hairy plums, neatest arrangement of gummy bears in a sock, arse most like its owner's elbow, and best potted meat of an unknown origin? Eventually, I thought it was time to head to the judge's tent and review the Thargoid watercolours for use of water, for use of colour, realism and correct usage of a tartan. I entered through the judge's tent flaps, and after spending a long time checking for artistry, boldness of vision, and whether the Thargoid's eyes followed you round the room, I picked my winner. Mostly because it really was the best one of the lot, but partly because of the whispered, "Beetle Jude is our favourite," followed by a handshake that rustled. Proxima Centauri was setting, if not in the west, at least in the top left corner of the station, as we settled into our places for the announcements and prize giving. The head judge was saying, "A prize for the best double entendre has been won by Lord Shouty, and so I'm going to give him one." When the door at the side of the stage burst open and a voice cried out, "They've gone! They've all gone! The mugs!" In the stunned silence that followed, I, Miss Marbles, wondered about three things. Who had taken the mugs? What did they want with them? And who had played that music? Never wanting to put myself forward, I stood outside the trophy room and peered through the forest of bodies that were crisscrossing the room. I couldn't work out how those at the back could see. Then I realised that they were using some kind of periscope. Ah, they do it with mirrors, I thought. What I could see, but only intermittently, was a large crate marked Hutton Mugs, traditional handle orientation, with the lid hanging open, but no obvious signs of damage. Could this be an inside job? Surely no one who lived and worked at Hutton would be seduced by the promise of easy credits by selling mugs on the black market. A Hutton mug that can be bought is a useless mug, but people still fall for them, probably whilst injecting drain cleaner or some such. Whilst I stood there puzzling, from around the corner came a sound with which I recognised, that of a mop being waltzed down a corridor. Hurrying after the source of the sound, I saw a figure dressed all in white, holding in his hand a shaft that in other circumstances might have been mistaken for a quarterstaff, so mighty was it. I tried, but I couldn't make him stop. However, he did mop around me in a circle. "You know something, don't you?" I inquired. As he rotated past, he looked up briefly and stared into my eyes. But his face was completely deadpan. I couldn't read anything in his gaze. "You knew this was going to happen. That's why you gave me that invitation, didn't you?" Still nothing. This was getting silly, and I was getting dizzy. "Who's responsible? Where should I start looking?" Again, he said nothing, but paused his gyration for a second, and from under his skin-tight white spandex outfit, he produced what smelled like a cup of coffee. I really don't want to think about where he was keeping it before, especially as it was still warm. I took the cup, and indeed it did contain coffee, with foamy milk on the top, and what at first looked like a little chocolate, but a quick sniff showed that it was some kind of cereal. When I glanced up from the surface of the drink, I found myself alone in the corridor, aside from my milky beverage. What could this mean? Where was he trying to point me? What was the moving finger indicating? Was it the work of the infamous Macchiato brothers, right-hand men to the infamous Donatinati? Could he be referring to the half-double decaffeinated half-calf with a twist of lemon revolutionary faction that can be found hiding in LS 340. Eventually, the penny dropped. Oh, that's better. I wondered what was chafing. Where was I? Oh, yes, my razor-sharp mind had leapt straight to the answer. The coffee was obviously meant to be cappuccino, and as everyone knows, the drink was named after the robes worn by cappuccino monks. Where is the most notorious band of monks in the galaxy to be found? Yes, dear reader, Van Maanen Star, home of the mad monks themselves. I was reminded of someone who used to live near me in the convent of St. Mary's in Meath installation. Eddie, just call me Sister Josephine Gridler, who was asked to leave the convent after several unsavoury and unsettling events which resulted in the intervention of the convent's authorities, such as dealing onion head during matins, being the only bass in the choir, toilet seats being left up for no good reason, and a stash of money found in a secret hole in the wall behind a poster of a tennis player scratching her behind. But the worst of the 13 problems was when he foolishly decided that what was absolutely essential during a trip to the house of the local vicar was a collection of crows. That was his downfall. Yes, the murder of the vicarage was Eddie's nemesis. I realised with a jolt that the reason that I had not heard Eddie's name shouted from the Galnet news outlets for a very long time was not that he'd turned over a new leaf and gone straight, but that Galnet news was silent on all topics. Very convenient for Eddie, I thought. To follow this clue, I realised that it was time to pack up my knitting and take a trip on the bus to Van Maan and Star. As I relaxed in the economy class cabin, I heard the pilot say, "We're taking an economical route today. First stop, Jackson's Lighthouse."
Jackson's Lighthouse. Jackson's Lighthouse.
As our ship completed its jump, I was simultaneously struck by how beautiful and bright the star was outside, by a sense of loneliness, as for the first time I was in a system containing no human habitation whatsoever, and by my umbrella, which fell from the overhead rack. I decided to stretch my legs during the preparations for charging the drive in the neutron star and look out at the six stars in this system. Whilst I stood at the porthole, gazing into the inky blackness of space, which was being violently pierced by the bright white neutron star and its hypnotically dancing jet cones, a tall figure, smartly dressed, came and stood beside me. "Beautiful, but deadly," the stranger said in a cultured and quiet voice. Indeed it is, Mr. I inquired. "My name is not important," he replied. "Let us just say that I am a fellow passenger who has travelled from Epsilon Indy to here, where I am to rejoin my ship, the Noob Scoop, to continue my trade of salvaging spare parts from ships that do not survive the supercharging process. A sad but surprisingly lucrative business. Before I disembark, can I give you some advice?" "Okay, Mr. Important, what is it?" "Let me give you some words of wisdom. Beware the monks, for they are not what they seem. Beware a one-legged seafaring man, for he has travelled to the wrong story. And beware the shrimp salad in the restaurant. Have you seen how far from the sea we are?" And with that he was gone, leaving me to wonder how he was going to transfer to his ship. The captain made an announcement over the tannoy that we were about to enter supercruise. At least, I think that's what he said. But he was all but drowned out by the raucous cries coming from what they laughingly called the reading room, which contained three books. One antique copy of the National Geographic, which fell open at the rude bits, and a very politically incorrect magazine containing many pictures that's been thumbed more often than the doorbell on a house of ill repute when the Space Force was in town. I made a note to complain to the captain about the body in the library as soon as we landed. The cabin was suddenly flooded with the bright light of the star, and the ship was tossed harder and further than a salad at a Texas barbecue. There were horrible groaning sounds from the ship's superstructure, and on the wall of my cabin the mirror cracked from side to side, and I was violently and urgently reminded of Mr. Important's advice regarding the shrimp salad. Eventually all became still, including my digestive system, and the captain announced that we were fueled and ready to proceed. I'd like to report that the rest of the journey was uneventful, but it seemed that our pilot wanted to test out how fast he could scoop fuel and how close to the sun he could get at every jump. The ice in my glass boiled, the gin evaporated. That was a crime when I'd poured a double. Sin to waste it, but what can you do? I soon forgot the problems of the trip as we arrived at Van Maan the Star and the ship came into land, passing closely above the famous monastery. I disembarked and took a harbour to the gate of the monastery. For those of you who may have used one, a harbour is like an Uber, but is considerably cheaper due to the driver's lack of spatial and temporal awareness, so you never know what it's going to turn up or when you get there, where there is. But as I say, they are cheap. How much, asked the driver? $4.50 from Paddington, came the very reasonable reply. The ground transport coughed and sputtered away, and I stood with my luggage looking for something resembling a doorbell on the vast, forbidding edifice of the monastery. Eventually, I found a bell pull in a small niche next to the gate, and I pulled it. From the other side of the wall, I heard two voices, one after the other crying, "Ding! Dong!" After a short while, two robed figures came to the gate. "Can we help you?" one asked. "Did you two just make the sound of a bell?" I replied. "Yes, I am the big ding, and here's the little dong," said the first monk. The second one said nothing, but looked down at his feet all the time, mumbling. "I'm looking for one of your order, Eddie Gridler," I said. The monk gasped. "Sister Josephine? Oh, she's right out of order. Expelled, in fact. Gone, packed a suitcase and left, taking her collection of erotica, unusually hairy forearms and surprisingly masculine perfume. She ran out of here like a box of shorts were on fire, and the last we heard was, 'Forward my mail to Mitterrand Hollow.'" "Bugger," I would have said, if I was given to expansive expletive expressions, but instead turned around, called for a hober, and sat down for the long wait. "What was that?" I exclaimed as large, dark and very quick shot past the canopy. The driver of the Hober, think Uber, but without the charm, sophistication, cleanliness, reliability, but with added one-star reviews, said, "We call it the Hollow. I'm just trying to get into position for it to land on us." Puzzled, I replied, "Don't you mean for us to land on it?" The driver snorted and laughed. "If you think you can do it that way, good luck to you. Me, I'm just going to plant myself here and wait for it to catch up to me." "Next time for sure," he said optimistically. I sat there and watched as he became more and more frustrated. The Hober's landing gear made gentle contact with the surface. I was able to set out once more in search of the missing mugs and the mysterious monk, Eddie Gridler. I decided that the best way to find him was by tracking his luggage, and so I sat down in a corner of the baggage hall, got out my knitting and the crossword, and so effectively faded into the background. Sure enough, after a short while, I overheard two baggage handlers, bored and playing catch with the suitcases, gossiping about how the TSA, you know, terminally snoopy agents, couldn't stop talking about how unmonk-like were the clothes that they found in a recent search, and how the owner claimed that their goat was an emotional support animal as they were born under Capricorn. Discreet inquiries. After all, people always talk to me and always underestimated my perspicacity and overestimated my ability to say perspicacity. Led me to understanding that this city had more than its fair share of goat lovers, which reminds me of a joke, but this is neither the time nor the place. And that there was an establishment run by a Mr. Albert Wonstone, which was a sort of kennel for goats. Okay, this one stone's goat kennels was a tenuous lead, and the lead up to an even more tenuous pun. But that, it was all I had. Packing up my puzzle in my old knit bag, I shook my space legs and soon found myself outside the building in question. And stepping inside, I looked around and went to the reception desk. Excuse me, am I at Bertram's Hotel? I asked. Yes, my ma'am, came the reply, from a figure who was wearing badly fitting dentures and covering me in spittle every time he spoke. This is Bertram's Hotel, where we stable your goat and supply the finest quarters, all for 6 credits per day. 6 credits, I responded unbelievingly, while simultaneously using my space handkerchief to wipe my face and remove the worst of the unexpected but definitely expectorated shower. Yes, I took a step backwards at this point, which sufficed to keep me away from the worst of the effects of the spittle transmittal, but had the unfortunate side effect of allowing a none too small puddle to start growing on the floor, presenting an altogether different risk to life and limb. We only charge 6 credits a day, cause a day here only lasts about 68 seconds. Most folks don't do the maths, and consequently, I have become a rich-ass crub-sush. All I wish for now is a life partner who doesn't mind the smell of goat, and I'm shorted. Steam was starting to rise for me at this point, and that, mixed with the pervasive smell of goat, made a powerful odour combination and made me anxious to find my quarry and be on my way before Goop decided to name a candle fragrance after my fragrant miasma. Can you help me, please? I'm looking for Eddie Griddler, I managed to say from a subtly safe distance. One moment, please, the clerk replied, and made the request for the monk over the tannoy. Unfortunately, he must have misheard me, or maybe it was his loose denture. Imagine my surprise as a girdler is announced. Luckily, it didn't seem to matter, as a figure in a dark robe with a cowl came into view, touched his forelock and confirmed that he was indeed the person for whom I was seeking, but he was on the run from the law and he'd had to leave the monastery after being found out. I enlightened him as to the purpose of my quest and asked him what he could tell me about the location of the missing hut and mugs. Like all griddlers, he was unable to come straight to the point, so we started off with rambling tales of his early life as a food smuggler, and the secret places they were forced to hide contraband to avoid scans. Apparently, the best food smuggler of all time was Greg Edwards, who could secrete vast quantities of food, for example, pulses, in various bodily cavities. Let's just say that he was known as the Caribbean Mr. E, and that the adventure of the Christmas pudding is not one for the faint-hearted. In an attempt to bring the conversation back on track, I pressed him again about the theft, and he reluctantly divulged a dark tale about the secret cult of the Guardians and how their followers believed that goats were their distant descendants of the Guardians, not the cultists. Oh, that reminds me of that joke again, but this is not the time nor the place. These adherents would stop at nothing to bring about their desired ends, whatever they are. He was pretty vague on this aspect, and that the best place to seek them was Sol, the birthplace of humanity. At this point, I was beginning to wonder if I'd done the right thing by trying to locate the missing drinking vessel. I'd been halfway across the galaxy and back, and I felt that I still didn't have a handle on where the mugs were, if you pardon the expression. Still, I thought a clue is a clue. So I once again used my senior Imperial Citizen's Space Bus Pass and metaphorically hitched a lift on the first available fleet carrier. Next stop, Sol. No, first stop for a shower and a change of clothes. Second stop, Sol. As I stared at the wall of the fleet carrier, feeling that all I needed was a strong smell of diesel to complete the illusion that I was below deck on a cross-country ferry to combat the intense boredom, I pondered on the events that had led me to this on this unlikely journey. For example, why had someone stolen the mugs in the first place? What did they hope to do with them? It started with floor mopping guy at Hutton giving me a clue, which had sent me to the Mad Monks and their apotheosis Eddie Gridler, only to be one step behind him, and then when I did catch up with him, I'd been sent on what might prove to be a wild goat's chase to Sol next door from where I started. But when I get to Sol, where should I start my search? The outlaw Gridler has been quite vague, and I couldn't spend time looking at every planet, asteroid, station and USS in the system. It would take far too long, and I'd already been told that this was the last episode. Better get a move on. So, a secret society worshipping goats. Something as silly as this would be run by men, naturally. So where would they have their headquarters? Of course, Venus. She was always associated with goats one way or another, though nothing was ever proven, via many mythologies and astrology over centuries. Burnell Station, a civilian outpost in orbit above Venus, looks a little forlorn as we approached, its five pads all in darkness, until we came into land. This had to be it. This would be where I would find the cult of the Guardians and with their mysterious sigils and unnatural rites. And I'd pack my camera just in case. The fact that the main imports for this station were beer and wine was the clincher, as we all know that secret male societies are just an excuse to have a funny handshakes, dress up and drink, and not necessarily in that order. I started to notice that there seemed to be more than the usual number of people wandering the corridors with capering companions, and that despite them doing their best to look nonchalant, they were all gradually drifting in the same direction, along with people who did have Clovenhoof companion, towards a room that was closed off by an old blanket, where two shifty-looking men seemed to be checking for something before allowing entry. I just had to know. So I got out my knitting again and tried to look every bit of my mostly harmless rating as I edged closer to the door. What was it they were looking for to allow entry? I got my first clue when all of the people with goats were waved straight through. This had to be the meeting of the cult of the goat, surely. Someone put their mouth close to the bouncer's ear and said, "I'm feeling horny," and was admitted. There were variations on this, such as, "I'm not kidding," "Nanny sent me," and "I'm a silly billy." Others showed some kind of symbol. One had what I sincerely hope was a piece of goat horn in his hand. Another had a piece of particularly smelly cheese. And one lady in very tight trousers just opened the front of her coat, which seemed to satisfy the doorkeeper. "I'm a friend of Buck," I said, a phrase which has got me out of trouble in many a seedy location, about as often as it caused everyone to turn and stare, accompanied by the sound of guns being cocked, but it was worth a try. Luck was with me, as a blanket was pulled back and I was ushered in. "Do you know the word hercene?" "No, neither did I, but believe me, it is a word that I know will stay with me for a long time. Much like the smell of goats, it's used to describe, and the rash I got from one of them rubbing against my leg. The meeting had started, and the man at the front, who was wearing a whole goat skin like a cloak and horns, surely he must have been hot in that, was saying something about manipulating the cost of low-temperature diamonds. "We must not allow them to be sold at the free mind price," he shouted. "We must consolidate all of our holdings in a sweeping merger. Then when the authorities check the curves of the prices over time, they won't think about the why their flatter mystery." These weren't the goat worshippers. This was nothing but a high finance meeting disguised as a religious revival, purely for the purposes of avoiding tax and sneaking in more book titles. This was not going to get me closer to the missing mugs, but it was my only lead. "Think, June Marbles. Think," I thought. "Are you back at the beginning? It was with a sinking heart that I realised that I had indeed come back to square one and that I must have been too hasty in departing the scene of the crime. Pausing only to buy a large stack of paperback books and a coffee at the Spaceport's branch of W.H. Schmidt's, even in the 34th century, branches can still be found in out-of-the-way locations, though to this day nobody knows why. I set off en route for Hutton Orbital. Well, that was a different journey from last time. I'd managed to obtain passage, which sounds ruder than it was, on a fleet carrier. And not only did I have a chance to read any of my books, but my coffee was still hot when I arrived. Coffee. That reminded me of something. As I wandered the corridors, sipping my Eninar coffee with frothy azure milk and a shot of Duringa's truffle syrup, my mind wandered back all the way to when this made up some kind of sense. And after all, a mystery wouldn't be a mystery without a deliberate misdirect in chapter one, would it? The coffee that the floor mopping guy had given me. Was that it on top that I'd mistaken for chocolate and thus assumed as a cappuccino? That had led me round the galaxy on a trail that only made sense if I was trying to draw a rude picture on EDSM. I recalled that it was some kind of cereal, and if you've forgotten that, dear reader, you should have paid more attention in episode one. But which? By the kind of coincidence that only occurs when you run into one person you're trying to avoid, or when the writer is desperate to get the end of a story, I smelled the odour of bread being baked. Not just any kind of bread, but Russian bread. Of course, the grains had got onto the coffee when floor mopping guy pulled it out because he had a pocket full of rye. So if it wasn't a cappuccino, what was it? It had to be an Italian, maybe even a macchiato. And I remembered that it had been cold. I felt so stupid. It was staring me in the face all along. If only I hadn't rushed off at the beginning. Still, no sense crying over chilled milk. I still had to find the mugs. I started following the smell of the rye bread, for it's a well-known fact that rye bread is a favourite among pirates, due to the fact that it lasts so long, but can be contaminated with a mould called ergot, which can cause hallucinations. Combine that with gut rot rum that they're fond of, and it's no wonder they're always looking for trouble. As I reached the end of the corridor, I could hear sizzling, and then I encountered the unmistakable smell of frying calamari. As far as I was concerned, that was the end of all doubt. Time to call in the cavalry and confront the misappropriating miscreant. I stepped into the room ready to perform a senior citizen's arrest. I knew the authorities would take some time to arrive. Ever had your sidewinder attacked in a so-called high security system? But to my surprise, all I could see was floor-mopping guy. Surely he couldn't be our thief. He turned away, and so I was able to observe him from the shadows. And I noticed that he didn't have put on weight recently. And why did he have that silly moustache? Aspetto un attimo. That wasn't floor-mopping guy. He was using a phone, talking out loud for a start. His hands constantly gesturing and saying, if he asks for cheese on his fish again, it's a horse's head in the bed for him. This was none other than the legendary head of the Camorra clan, the dastardly Don Antonacci. What was he doing here? As he still had his back to me, I crept out and wound my knitting around his knee-length leather boots before standing up and shouting, Don Antonacci, you are under arrest. The silly boy tried to run, tripped over my reverse stockinette, fell headlong and lay there looking at the feet of the assistant patrolman who'd just arrived, late to the party as usual. It was the smell of your dinner that gave you away, pirate, I said triumphantly. I'd have gotten away with it if it wasn't for those pesky squids, he replied sadly. Without your mugs to strive for, your hut knights would have lost heart, and we pirates could have taken our rightful place at the head of the galaxy. Searching the room revealed a cupboard containing one floor-mopping guy, minus his uniform and all of his other clothes as well. I was quite distracted by the sight of his muscles. It looked as though he was hiding several ferrets under a blanket, and his tendons rippled. He turned to face me, and oh my, that reminded me, where was his long-handled mop? Desperate to look away, I spotted a pile of Hutton mugs in the corner, but one or two didn't look completely empty. Floor-mopping guy mimed, "Sorry." I guess he was in that cupboard for longer than I thought. Still, never mind, they'll wash. The prize giving at the reconvened fete went off without a hitch, and Beetle Jude won the prize for best watercolour painting of a Thargoid wearing a kilt, as we all knew she would. But I personally doubted that you'd see any Thargoid life in real life in such a large skein do under his kilt, especially if it was cold. The best part of travelling is coming home, so they say, and I was very happy to get back to the ex-convent of St. Mary's in Mead installation, and as my friend offered to make me a cup of fusion tea, I heard the Hobo driver shout from the front door just before it closed, "I've unloaded all of the luggage. These are Miss Marble's final cases."
That was This Other Eden, being the casebook of Miss Marbles and the story of the pilfered porcelain. Miss Marbles was played by Commander Flossie. The narrator was Commander Flossie, and the other parts were played by Commander Flossie. Incidental sounds were made by the Hutton Orbital Players and saved for blackmail purposes, and the whole thing was an overblown production for Hutton Orbital Radio.